Good morning, everyone. Well, this week I've had already my challenges with this nutrition program, so you know that the devil is working hard because something good must be happening, right? So I have to apologize. I left you all hanging on the topic of cancer, and I'm going to have to continue it to tomorrow. Prayerfully, it will happen. I was working on my PowerPoint presentation yesterday and ended up losing 75 of my slides. So I stayed up and finished it all again, and now it's refusing to open my program. So there must be something I'm not to show you in there. I don't know. But I know we're doing this week the ABCs of nutrition. If this is your first time here this week, we're going through the alphabet, putting it into the categories of the different things, of the different vitamins found in different foods, different nutrients, and just different health practices, all to do with the alphabet. So we're going to jump ahead under E for exercise. And the sun is bright and shining, and it looks good out there, and so hopefully this is a good topic to get everyone motivated to enjoy some fresh air and some exercise. So we'll begin with taking fitness in stride. Now, before I forget, there was one thing I wanted to mention about calcium that I had missed mentioning to you yesterday. Remember I talked on the topic of calcium and quinoa being very high in calcium and the benefits of calcium and so forth. If you take a calcium supplement, it's really important to take calcium citrate. That is the type of calcium that your body absorbs and uses the most. So calcium citrate, you don't want calcium carbonate. And if you are taking a supplement, if you can do it in the plant-based liquid form, that's going to be your highest absorption as well. Now, interesting enough, most of your supplements that you take should be taken first thing in the morning when your absorption is the highest and you're able to get that most benefit from. However, calcium is an exception. Calcium absorbs while you sleep. So you should actually take calcium. You should take calcium at nighttime when you go to bed so that it can absorb while you sleep. And yesterday as well, we talked about sleep patterns and between what time is the best, is your deepest sleep that you're relying on. What time in the night? You remember? 2 to 3. That's right. You're a good class. 2 to 3 in the morning. That's when you should be in your deepest sleep to produce those hormones, right? Which also goes into the melatonin to help you sleep well. Well, if you're having trouble sleeping at night, it can also be a calcium deficiency. So taking your calcium at night before you go to sleep can help you sleep through the night easier. I've had people who take sleeping pills, and I've got them to try a plant-based liquid calcium supplement, and they don't have to take sleeping pills anymore. That calcium helps them through the night. There's different brands out there. The brand that I have had the best experience with is the brand Flora. Some of you might have heard of Flora. Flora is a plant-based liquid calcium, but it also has your magnesium, which works together. Your calcium and magnesium need each other to absorb. It has vitamin D and it has zinc. So all four are together for the highest absorption. So that's the one I like to promote the most. You know, and a lot of times, even children, someone asked me, well, what age group, you know, needs to take or should take calcium or shouldn't take calcium? You know, it doesn't matter. Some, you know, you might be 60 years old and you don't need to take calcium supplement. That's fine. You need to determine, you know, if you're low in it or not. If you're having low bone density, then you may need that to give you that extra boost. But then there's also children. Have you ever heard of growing pains? Sometimes we'll say they have growing pains. And that's actually a lack of magnesium, not calcium. But because they work together, I use the same supplement. And children can take a little bit of that before bed, and the pain is gone, and it you know, takes care of that need that they have. So hopefully that clarifies up that calcium a bit more that I forgot to share with you yesterday. Okay, now let's jump into fitness today. All right, so why do we care about being active, first of all? Well, you know what? Active people just generally have more fun, don't they? So we need to be active. Second, they are not restricted by physical limitations, and they look and they feel better. Another one, some activities, they take strength, some take flexibility, some take cardiovascular endurance. in order to perform well. And so to enjoy these sports, you need to be fit. And as you can see, skiing is one of those challenges. At least for me, it can be a challenge. Also, to not be limited by physical problems such as excess weight or lack of energy. You need to have good health in order to foster good relationships, good healthy relationships, like an ability to hike. You could sit here, you're okay, you're close. To hike with your grandkids, perhaps, or your own children. And the issue here is there is actually less activity being performed for just general good health. You know, a lot of times we think of exercise as something that we need if we need to lose weight or if, you know, only special people need actual exercise. But in reality, we all need exercise just to get our bodies even functioning and being alive. 54% of adults report little or no regular activity. Most teenagers, they are not performing activity unless they're involved in an actual organized sport of some sort. And we know obesity is increasing in both adults and children. And can I add pets? And let's clarify, this is not my dog, okay? I used to have a habit of saying, and here my dog, thinking on my slide, not my dog. And it took for my family to follow me one weekend and hear this to clue in that people are assuming this is my pet I'm showing all the time. But this is not my dog. But, you know, you can even Google now, and Google fat pets, and people proudly put their pets on this website showing their fat pets. And, you know, on there, you will see overweight dogs, overweight cats, overweight budgies. I wonder, how does a budgie become overweight? And a hamster. You know, there was this hamster that was so round, it just rolls. It can't even crawl, and it just rolls across the cage floor. And I started to think, how is it? How can these pets become this way? I mean, really? Well, have you ever walked down that pet food aisle? There's always this little section of pet treats. And you know, it's interesting, we as humans, the same thing we've done to ourselves, where we provide nice treats for ourselves, end up making us sick or overweight or other issues. We've done the same to our pets. And if you look for hamsters, you can buy yogurt drops. And that's a nice little treat for them. Or is it? Sure. Is our hamsters made to eat dairy? No, you know, they're not made to eat dairy and then sugar and all refined things in it that really makes them sick. And so, unfortunately, we're doing the same thing to our pets. And you know, it used to be we would say to motivate us to exercise, to get a pet. So that this pet, you have to take your pet for a walk and, you know, it motivates you to exercise. But the unfortunate thing is the pets are taking us for the walks now. And so, you know, hopefully we can get a pet and help each other, I suppose. So we know that there is a need, and it's a growing need. Other reasons, active people enjoy better health in general. And we're going to look at some of these advantages that are brought on by this lifestyle. So there's different benefits, as I said, flexibility, strength, and cardiovascular. And cardiovascular is just kind of what keeps your heart pumping, more or less, and keeps that blood flowing from the tip of your head to the tip of your toes. And so cardiovascular, having to do with the heart, plays a role on cholesterol as well. And I mentioned to you yesterday about a good cholesterol and a bad cholesterol. And so here we are. It'll increase your good cholesterol after 12 weeks of training. And your body will make cholesterol as long as you give it what it needs to make this good cholesterol. And so here we are. It'll increase it. Now, it'll take about 12 weeks. It takes more time if you don't do anything diet-wise or lifestyle-wise. But exercise only, it'll still have an effect, but it takes a longer period of time. It'll decrease your blood pressure. And what about if you have too low a blood pressure then? You probably shouldn't walk, right? You should sleep lots and... No, opposite actually. It's interesting, if you give the body what it needs, it'll work for you either direction. So if you have too high a blood pressure, exercise will lower it, and if you have too low a blood pressure, it'll raise it. So it knows where it needs to be as long as you give it what it needs to work with. It'll improve your insulin sensitivity. So what type of people especially benefit from that? Diabetics, exactly. Decreases the risk of your red blood cells sticking together. You actually want your red blood cells to repel each other. You want your blood to be nice and free-flowing and your red blood cells to just kind of, you know, refuse to shake hands. But once they start to cling and stick together, they'll clump, and this can cause all sorts of problems like strokes, a heart attack, that's right. And so we don't want this to happen. It'll maintain or increase bone density. Exercise will increase bone density. So we talked yesterday about a plant-based calcium to help build the bones. Now we need exercise to help build the bones. And actually, if you can do some type of weight-bearing exercise along with it, that will help build bone density as well. And so again, I think I might have mentioned this yesterday about purchasing, maybe I didn't, 2 or 3 pound weights. You can go to Walmart and just buy those little weights and put one in each hand and go for a walk and swing your arms, and you've got that weight-bearing exercise. Even though it's only 2 pounds in each arm, you will feel it, trust me. And you can work your way up from there. But that's enough to make a difference. It'll decrease your risk of cancer. Is that worth it? Yep. Definitely. Because how many, what's your chance of cancer right now? 50%. 50-50 chance. So anytime we can do something to try to prevent it is important. Helps to control stress and anxiety. I probably don't have to talk about that because most of you are stress-free, right? Well, let me tell you, exercise is the number one thing you need for stress and anxiety. Your body makes a hormone called cortisol. And this cortisol actually destroys your body. When you go to sleep at night, again, we talked about this yesterday. What are the three R's? What does it do for rest, restoration, and relaxation? That's right. Have you ever woke up in the morning and you just kind of ache and you hurt and you crawl out of bed and you think, wow, a truck hit me and I didn't even see it? Have you ever felt that way? That's the effects of cortisol. So if you have cortisol in your bloodstream when you go to bed at night, instead of healing and resting, your body ends up being destroyed. It's being attacked as you sleep. So the key is to get rid of that cortisol. Pump it out of your bloodstream so when you go to sleep, you can actually heal. And the only way to do that is exercise. Pump that old blood out and get that new blood in. And so even though maybe some people find they can't exercise at evening because it'll keep you awake at night, just means then go for a walk earlier in the evening, maybe when you first come home from work. Just go for a 20-minute brisk walk. Just pump that old stressed blood out and get some fresh blood in, and you will sleep much better. Okay, helps to control, as I said, stress and anxiety. Now, what about if you have a very active job and you're on your feet all day? That's exercise, isn't it? But is it stress-releasing? No. So unless it's stress-releasing, you still need to do a form of exercise to help you get rid of the stress. I mentioned to you I used to work for an eye clinic, and I would be on my feet sometimes 12, 14 hours straight, working all day. And when my husband and I first got married, we come home from work, and he had a desk job. He was an accountant. And he would come home, and I'd be laying on the couch napping. And he'd look at me, and he'd say, "You know what you need? You need to exercise." And I thought, wow, what does he think I do all day, you know? I mean, do you think I sit at a desk with my feet up? I was greatly insulted. And he says, no, I'm not saying that. I just say you need exercise. Well, you know, I was very slim and trim then. I weighed like 95 pounds, and the last thing I needed was exercise in my mind. And you know what? He was right. When he took me up to the challenge to go jogging with him, he would faithfully jog every day, and I wouldn't. And I began to jog with him. I couldn't keep up to him. In fact, yeah, I struggled through that one. And it really showed me that I needed some exercise in my life. But it, you know, you need to do something still to remove that stress and anxiety. It's not just about physical movement. Your job, being active, is important to just stay healthy. But we need to go a little bit beyond that. And it treats depression. So again, yesterday we talked about sleep really important for depression. We know sunlight, we're going to talk more about sunlight during the week, but sunlight will set off those hormones, again, you remember the serotonin, to make you happy and feel good. So the best time to exercise is as that sunlight comes up. And if you can catch that sunrise, that'll just help you produce those hormones a little bit faster and in more and of abundance. So depression, really important to go for some nice fresh air walks. Helps control osteoarthritis. Again, if you can do the 1 or 2 pound weights, improves symptoms of Alzheimer's. Well, now you've got the circulation flowing right to the brain, and circulation is the key when it comes to Alzheimer's. So again, very important. And you know, even in young people, it might not be Alzheimer's, but we can tell when our memory isn't there and someone asks you a question and you're not sharp. This exercise will get the oxygen flowing and you'll be more alert and more keen. Improves fibromyalgia, improves chronic fatigue syndrome. You know, in a lot of cases, unfortunately, most of us will rust out before we wear out. And the reason is when we start to have aches and pains and stiffness, we think, oh, you know what, I can't exercise, or I can't walk, or I'm in too much pain. And in reality, that's when the pain is allowed to set in more. So we need to put forth some effort. Just do what you can do. A little bit is better than none, and work your way up from there. Walking in all cases where it is possible is the best remedy for diseased bodies, because in this exercise, all the organs of the body are brought into use, and there is no exercise that can take the place of walking. So, walking is the key. It's right out your door, you dress for the weather, and it's inexpensive. Doesn't that sound like the perfect activity, doesn't it? Now, what about jogging? Jogging is okay. If you like jogging, that's fine. The most important thing is make sure you're wearing really good shoes to give you that support. And you may choose to run on grass versus cement if you can. That helps as well in the joints. But walking is still better. You know why? Even though jogging, you'll burn calories faster. Walking, you know, you just have to walk a little bit longer, fast pace. But it's actually in posture. It's about posture. When you're walking, you're nice and straight, and your lungs are able to fully expand and breathe that full oxygen in. When we jog, we're kind of hunched over, and you squish your lungs, and they can't fill up fully with oxygen. So walking is actually your best exercise. Bike riding is excellent too. You know, any of these activities are good, and it's important to have variety. It makes it exciting, right? Now I want to go through with you some of these studies. Sorry, I didn't plan to do exercise today. And I just have some cheat sheets I have to find. These are some studies. I just want to make sure I don't miss telling you something here on these studies. But this one here, for example, was to do with heart attacks. And this one was done particularly with women. And the women tested here, they walked briskly for about 3 hours. And they were able to cut the risk of a heart attack by nearly 50%. See right here, 52? Almost 50% by just walking the 3 hours per week. So that could be a half hour, 6 days a week. And they were able to cut it in half. Brisk walking now for 5 hours or more a week cut their risk even further. Now, look at this. There's only about a 10% change, isn't there, between going very vigorous exercise versus the 3 hours per week. So it does improve. The more you do, the more it improves. But my point here is it doesn't mean you have to be this super athletic person out there jogging for an hour a day every day to get a benefit. If you can focus on, you know, 5 days a week doing about 40 minutes, that'll cut most of your risks by 50%. Isn't that outstanding? Okay, I'll show you some more here. This one is with men. And it's on high blood pressure was the testing that they did there. So again, about half the risk of those who were least active. And the nice thing about this study is it's not necessarily getting out there and walking or jogging. It's just daily activity level. Just being active in some way cut their risk of having high blood pressure in half once again. The next one is on diabetes. Now this one again is with men, and this is with the protective risk of getting diabetes, against getting diabetes. And again, the more highly fit a person was, or the man was, the less risk of obtaining diabetes. Yes?
If you have had diabetes for a long time, over 10 years,
yes.
Can you reverse it by doing some of this?
Type 2? Okay, the question was, if one has had diabetes for a very long time, can it be reversed? Type 2, yes, at any point it can be reversed. Type 1 is still a benefit to stabilize it, but of course the pancreas has stopped working, so you know that cannot be reversed, but it can be stabilized. Yes?
So I have type 1 diabetes. I was out of control until God suggested that I should do something about it more than I was. So now I'm exercising, and with the proper vegan diet, I've eliminated all the meds that they had me on and only using half the amount of insulin now that I was before.
Correct. That's correct. That's right. You probably, you know, you won't be able to come totally off that insulin, but you're able to control it and stabilize it. Absolutely. So that's wonderful. Excellent. That's a wonderful testimony. And you know, in all these things I'm teaching you through the week, I want you just to pick out some of the things that'll work for you and begin there and just work your way up. I realize we're all at different levels and we're all dealing with different issues in our life. And some of this might be overwhelming, all the information I give you. And I don't expect you to do it all, but some things will stand out to you, and begin with those. And just an example, when I had spoken once, way up north in Alberta here, there was a man that had diabetes, type 2 diabetes, and he picked out just a few things to begin, to give a try to, and see, you know, if these things really could work. And by the next time I returned, a couple months later, I had done this for the church there. They didn't have to do any advertising. This man did all the advertising for them. And when I walked in, they're like, quick, quick, come see the news. This man has advertised you all over the place. And we listened to him, and he had charts and everything done up. But and even I met him that night again when I went to speak, and all these people came, and he says, oh, you're a celebrity. And I said, no, I think you're the celebrity. And so I had him get up and introduce what he had done. And he had his jar of quinoa to show, and he had different things, you know, oh, she said this and this. And he showed how much his sugars came down and were in control. And he said, just think, I only chose 5 things to choose to do, and look what happened. Imagine if I did it all. So, you know, what I want you to do is choose a few things that work for you. You'll see what happens. You'll get excited, and then you'll try a few more. That's what I did. That's, you know, that's the best way to do it. And you have to change for you, not for me, not for anyone else. You have to make that decision. And when you see it happening in your life, there's nothing more, you know, invigorating than that. So, any other questions? Okay, we will continue. Oh, on this one, I just wanted to mention again. So low fit have 3.7 times greater risk of diabetes here than the higher fit. That's what this means. 3.7 times greater risk. Okay, this one here now is the risk of early death in diabetics. So people who actually have diabetes. And again, this study went on for over 8 years. Almost 3,000 people were enrolled in it. Those who walked only 2 hours per week dropped their overall death rate by 39%. Just 2 hours a week. So a half hour, 4 days a week, decreased their risk of death by 39%. I think that's huge for just 4 days a week of a half hour. That's nothing, is it? And then those who chose to walk 3 to 4 hours per week, so a half hour a day, 5-6 times a week, they dropped their overall death risk by 50%. Over 50%, actually. So, exercise helps counteract much of the harmful aspects of diabetes. And so this is, again, one way of reducing your risk. Okay, physical activity, when it has to do with strokes. So again, moderately fit, men who were moderately fit here had 63% fewer strokes than the low-fit men. So again, moderate fit. This is not meaning you have to be out there jogging every day. Just putting in your half hour 4 or 5 times a week will again decrease your stroke risk by 63%. High fit, 68% fewer chance of fewer strokes. So again, between the moderate and the high fit is only a 5% difference. It still helps, but it shows you, you don't, you know, just get out there and do something, it'll lower your risk. I've thrown this in here just so you understand what METS means. Sometimes you'll see this in a book or on something that tells you about METS. And METS is the rate at which you are burning your calories. So for example, one MET is the amount of energy that you would use, your body would expend over per minute while you are sitting quietly. So right now you are burning 1 MET per minute for calories. Now if you were to get up and start walking really quickly around the room, you would be burning about 4 METs. So you would actually burn 4 times the calories that you are right now. And then if you decided you really have had enough and this talk is really boring or it's super motivating, you'd start running around the room and now you would burn 10 times the energy, 10 times the calories as you are right now sitting. That's what METS means, how much energy you're expending in that per minute. Okay, how about even hip fracture rates? This was done for women, were tested here specifically who walked 4 hours per week again. They reduced the risk of a hip fracture rate by 41%. So that shows you how it builds bone density, doesn't it? Because that's the way it decreases the hip fracture rate. It builds bone density. So again, the question as I asked you yesterday, can osteoporosis be reversed? Yes. Cancer. High fit people have a 55% lower cancer mortality rate than low fit people. Even after controlling smoking, age, BMI, alcohol, and diabetes, taking these all out of the picture, you can still lower your risk of cancer by 55%. Isn't that huge? So again, you know, it might seem like a one-all, cure-all program that I'm teaching you this week, and it truly is. It doesn't matter if you have cancer or diabetes or heart disease, you give your body what it needs and it can work from there. It's just how your body chooses to respond. So other things here to do with active people versus inactive. They are less likely to catch a cold or a flu bug. When you are active, it builds the immune system. The important thing is you must begin at the level you're at. Don't jump excitedly into a program and decide that I've motivated you and you're going to go jogging for 5 miles and come back. Chances are you may get wheezy and actually get a cough and have a respiratory type, cold that you'll find in the end happens. And that's what happened to me. When I decided I was going to jog with my husband and prove to him I was in as good a shape as him, I ended up wheezing and coughing and I had a cold, a chest cold, for almost 2 days just from doing that. And so it can lower your immune system or it can raise it. So begin at the level you are. Don't be a hero. Start where you are and work your way up. That's a real hero. Putting it forth effort. They are happier, less depression. You've got that, again, those hormones that are being able now to be produced to make us feel more positive and happy. When we're discouraged or stressed or down, exercise is the best thing. You know how they say walk it off? Well, there's double benefit to that. It's double benefit. That exercise is going to help it as well. They are less likely to be overweight because now you're burning some calories. They have more energy. You know, it's really strange. I remember when I was first going to exercise in the morning, I thought, these people are crazy. You're telling me to exercise in the morning and then I'm supposed to have energy to get through my day? I will drop. But it's completely the opposite. So if you've never tried it, you must try it. You know, for me now, if I don't have exercise in that morning, as my day goes through, I can feel it. I feel that difference, and I know it's because I didn't exercise in the morning. It gives you that energy you need to get you through. So, you know, the morning again, when that sun is coming up, that fresh air is the ideal time. You're more optimistic about life, you will sleep better, and you will have less pain. Again, exercise. is anti-inflammatory, anti-pain, because of the type of hormones it's helping to produce that help with the pain and inflammation issue. You know, I had a lady once who had fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome, and I encouraged her to do a walk with us at one of my workshops. It was a 1 mile walk test, and I encouraged her to go. And she finally went, but afterwards she really wasn't very happy with me that I had made her go, and I felt kind of bad about it. But you know, the next morning she came to me and she said, "You know what? I slept like a baby." She said, "I haven't slept in months." But at first she wouldn't talk to me that day before. And then that next morning she was sitting there at the back just looking at me, and I just thought, oh man, I blew it. And she came up to me, and the way she said it, she said, "Last night you made me walk." And I said, "I know," and I'm apologizing frantically to her. And she goes, "I slept like a baby." But it's true. Sometimes, you know, we don't realize that that is what we need. We think it's going to hurt us more, but in reality, that's the medicine that we need, right? Active people live longer. Compared to inactive people, those getting regular activity, they cut their risk of death from any cause now by 50 to 75 or 73%. So we were created to be active, to move, to keep things flowing. And so we need exercise. When we are sick, who can you help? No one. It doesn't go beyond that bed, does it? And we have been given two special tasks on earth as humans. The first one is to serve God, and the second one is to serve our fellow man. And we can't do either one when we're sick. So number one priority, we have to take care of ourselves so that we can help take care of others, right? And so staying active does that. So here's some six proven simple steps. So number one, walking. As we mentioned, it's right out your door. Everyone can do it. And the thing is, it can be a social interaction. It can be fun. Do it as a family. You know, this is not just an adult-only program. This is for children, too. I remember Dr. Deal telling us that his son, when he was younger, as he would jog, his son would walk or jog, and Hans Deal would run circles around him all the way down the road. So, you know, sometimes you have to do what you can do. And for us, our children, we get on their bikes. And my husband and I would walk, but our children would ride their bike back and forth, you know, and keep coming back to us and go a little further. So you got to do what it takes to make it fun for the whole family and make it a family interaction thing. And you know, it's not just walking, like you asked, what about biking? Sure, what about skiing? You know, the main thing is you have to choose something you feel good at, something that's going to encourage you. For me, if I had to rely on skiing, my exercise would be limited to once a year. Just ask my children. I do it for them. They go up and down about 5 times, and I'm still trying to figure out how to get down the hill without killing myself. And, you know, I do it the once a year to make everyone happy, or at least to provide entertainment. I'm sure that's probably more the case, but, you know, I'll be a good sport. Swimming is an excellent exercise, especially if people have joint problems. But, you know, if you're somebody that's uncomfortable in a swimsuit, you feel self-conscious, people are looking at you, don't put yourself through that trauma. That's not good. Do something you feel good at, because that's how you're going to grow. You know, you need to do what you're comfortable with. If it's winter time, sometimes it's hard to get out on that sidewalk and it's really slippery and icy. Maybe a treadmill is worth investing into. Don't get the kind, though, that you push. It's really hard on the lower back. You need an electric treadmill. And we invested in one when my children were quite small, because it was hard for me to get out with the babies and the kids and what to do. So my husband bought me a treadmill. And, you know, again, you have to do what it takes to make it happen. And I remember putting my little guy in a little car seat to sit there and watch me, and I'd be entertaining him, clapping my hands, singing. I'm probably about 20 minutes, I'm ready to pass out, but at least I got exercise, I guess. But it's good when it's really icy outside. But you know, I encourage you, when you can get outside, it's an extra bonus, because you've got that fresh air and that sunlight, and just a different view than four walls around you, right? Sometimes a pedometer is an encouragement. These are those little things you can hook onto your waist, and when you walk, it'll measure how many steps. There's different ones out there that are getting better all the time. My husband and I would go for a walk, and we'd come back, and I'd look, and I'd go, wow, almost 3,000 steps. And he would pull his off and go, oh, good, I did 5. So his didn't measure, and he would tease me that I kind of walk a little heavy compared to him. But I bought him one that's really sensitive and just slips into your coat pocket, and it measures it really good. So there's different ones out there. Get one that works for you. But it is encouraging to have. And with my clients, especially those that want to get into the exercise, want to lose weight, walking will help you lose weight. I know people have shed tons of pounds just by walking. And make it the goal of 6,000 steps a day. And sometimes, I can be a little bit hard in this area of having that goal, and I'll say, well, your goal is 6,000. You better look at it a little bit early in the evening, because you can't go to bed until that says 6,000. And so, so make it your goal to begin with. And this you wear all day, so all your activity counts, and then the exercise of what it takes to make it to that 6,000. And your ultimate goal is to work your way up to 10,000. And so our saying is 10K a day. 10K a day is the ideal how many steps to do a day for exercise. It's about two miles a day is what it ends up being in exercise. You want to do about 2 miles a day for exercise, which is on top of your steps during your activities as well. So in general, 30 to 60 minutes a day of exercise. So you saw how 30 minutes a day, 4 to 5 times a week, that is what everyone should aim for, just to be in good health. Now, if you're trying to lose weight, you need to go beyond that. The first 30 minutes is cardiovascular. Anything after the 30 minutes begins to really burn the fat. So if you're trying to do it for weight loss, you have to go for that longer period of time if you can. And that'll make the difference. The other thing we've noticed is don't go hard at it for that whole time. Go hard and then slow down. Speed it up, slow down. So give yourself that bit of a rest between, but you will burn fat faster if you can do that. If you can go hard at it for 2 minutes, slow down for a minute. Hard at it for a couple of minutes, slow down for a minute. And that'll make a difference. Now, cardiovascular, when I say 30 minutes a day, if it's just cardiovascular and we're not talking specifically about burning fat, you can do 10 minutes here, you could do 5 minutes here, you could do 10 minutes here. We know now that it adds up to be those 30 minutes, and that counts as the 30 minutes. But for burning fat, you have to go steady for that longer period of time. Sometimes having some type of a fitness log is important. Here you're able to keep track of what your goals are and what you want to achieve. And you can see when you look back, all these check marks or gold stars, and then suddenly you see all this blank area and you kind of go, ooh, And it encourages you to get back on track, hopefully. The thing I find that works the best to keep you going is to have someone to make you responsible for it. So whether it be a spouse or another child, or a child in your family, or a neighbor, or a friend, somebody that can make you be there to make it happen. Sometimes you wake up in the morning and you think, it's 6 o'clock, it's a little bit early, and my bed's so warm, and the sun's not out, or whatever, like we felt yesterday morning. I noticed there's a few more people here today. Yesterday, I don't think any of us felt like crawling out of our beds. But if you have this friend waiting for you on the corner, you kind of think, wow, that poor friend, if I really consider them a friend, I shouldn't leave them standing there in the rain, and here I am in my warm bed. So it makes you get out and go meet that friend. And chances are that friend didn't feel like crawling out of bed either, but they're thinking, I'm going to leave my friend standing on that corner. So having someone to make you be there and make it happen is important. Make it social. Make it fun. A lot of the churches now are starting these walk clubs, and it's a great ministry to get into in the churches. I've helped kick a few off this year already in the spring, and we've had a community health program, and then we set up to meet a few times a week, and they get together and they just go for walks every day and create that friendship. There's, you know, friendship ministry is the way to go. And so a walking club is an excellent opportunity. Now, if you have issues when it comes to health, especially heart concerns, high blood pressure, these types of things, you know, mention it to your doctor. Tell your doctor, this is what I want to begin. I want to start an exercise program. Do you have any concerns? And listen to any concerns they may, you know, wish to share with you. Because again, it's important to start at the level you're at and work your way up. If it's going to kill you, it's not a benefit, right? So you want to make sure that you're not putting yourself in danger, but instead you're going to be something that can heal you. And so one of the tests that are really excellent to do is when you are walking. You know, I tell people you can get a special watch that will even tell you what your heart rate is and what percent of your heart rate you want to aim towards and that sort of idea. So that's something you can do if you have heart concerns. But you know, most people, you can tell when your heart is pumping a little faster, can't you? Faster than what it is right now. That is your aim, just to get your heart rate going. Get it up there a bit. But the best test to do is talk and see. If you can talk, then you're at a good rate. So people might think you're crazy if you don't have a partner, but just, you know, talk a little bit and see how comfortable you are. And if that's comfortable, try to sing. And if you sing and you sing comfortably, it means you need to pick up your pace, because you shouldn't be able to sing, but you should be able to talk. If you can't talk, you have to slow it down a bit. If you can sing, speed it up a bit. Does that make sense? That is the best test you can do. And you will find sometimes you just have to push yourself a little faster. As you get into the exercise program, you have to push a little bit faster to make it so that you can't sing, you know? Yes?
Could you explain no pain, no gain?
That is coming. Yes, there is a slide exactly of that, so I will hit that. Okay, I just want to discuss BMI. Many of you have probably heard of BMI, which stands for Body Mass Index. And this is sort of, you know, by the World Health Organization has put this together. And it calculates the body weight in kilograms by the square of his or her weight. So let me show you an example. You can take your weight in pounds. You can divide it by what your height is in inches, times itself again. So if, you know, here someone's 69 inches tall times 69 inches tall. So you would take 145 pounds, 145 divided by what this number comes to, always times by 706. That's the number you times it by. And that'll give you your BMI. So that's the equation if you want to figure it out that way. But you can Google it, you can go to different textbooks, and you'll find charts on BMIs now. And they have some really nice fancy ones as well. Everyone got that written? No? All right, looks like most writing has stopped. Yes?
Just a quick question on that. Is that a red thing to what culture you're living in and what area of the world you live in?
This is set up for supposed to be anybody. But I'll show you what the issues are with it. And it does vary, yes. It's not the perfect plan by any means. So these are the fancy charts that you will come across. You can Google, like I said, or in books or so forth. And this one is even nicely color-coded. So here, if it's light blue, you're underweight. If it's in the red zone, you're a healthy weight. Green, overweight. And yellow is obese. So here, in this case, you don't have to do any of that calculation. You just come down and you find your height. So let's say you're 5'4", and then you're, let's say, 130 pounds. You come over here, you're 22, which tells you you're a healthy weight. So very easy, your height, your weight, and then come down to where you fit, which category. So that tells you your BMI using a chart instead of the calculation. Now, as we were just mentioning, this BMI, if you look back here, I bet some of you would look at it and go, oh, not a chance. If I had to be this thing, I would be a toothpick, or, you know, and in that case, it really does vary, because there are issues with this BMI. First of all, you know, it's based on assumptions that may not apply to all people. It doesn't take into account body fat percentage. You can have two people that actually weigh exactly the same, and one is muscular and one is more fat, because muscle weighs as well. So, you know, that does not take into account of that. That's an issue. It doesn't distinguish differences between genders, which is, again, you know, many of the men would look at that chart and go, are you kidding? Usually it's the men that say, not a chance. If I were that weight, you know, I would be a skeleton. It doesn't tell you much about a person's individual body composition. So if you are small bone, medium bone, large bone, and by the way, here's a little test you can do for that. Take your middle finger and your thumb, and if you can wrap it around your wrist and it kind of overlaps just slightly or whatever, then you know you are small boned. If it's where it just barely touches, you're medium boned, and if there's a space, you're large boned. So that's the way to tell with your wrist if you're small, medium, or large boned. So if you're large boned, it's going to make a difference on your weight. But if you're small boned, you're going to have to be a lighter person, right? So people who are very small boned and carry extra weight are actually higher risk for things like osteoarthritis, osteoporosis. So if you're small boned, it's important to keep your weight down, even if you're large boned, but it just doesn't have as much effect sometimes. Okay, it overemphasizes scale weight as a measure of ideal, as the ideal body composition. And so, like we said, muscle weighs as well. So, you know, being that weight doesn't necessarily mean it's the ideal body composition. And it doesn't account for other lifestyle risk factors aside from weight. Okay, so working on here, so what are healthy body fat ranges? Sometimes we look at the scale and we see this. But there are special scales you can get now that tells you how many pounds you weigh, but it'll also tell you what percent is body fat. And that's, I really like those scales because I encourage people to pay more attention to the body fat number than the actual weight number. Many cases you're trying to lose weight and you get on that scale and you see you're losing pounds and suddenly it stops, it plateaus. And you get really discouraged with that. But what you don't realize is your exercise and such might be building the muscle. And so the weight isn't changing, the fat is decreasing, but they're kind of changing off that the weight doesn't actually change. So you can buy these scales now. Any place you can find scales, you can find the scales that tell you what percent is body fat. And those are the ideal scales to use. Now these are our healthy body fat ranges where we like to be in. So anyone under the age 30 for males want to be between 14 and 20 over age 30, you know, and so forth. And females are different than the males in this case. Children are different as well, and seniors have to be different a little bit as well, too. You do have to be careful of that. The main concern is, what if you're above in this number? Obviously, the body fat is too high, and that's a risk for a number of different diseases, and we'll talk more about that later in the week. But what if you're under? What if you're like 10 here, or what if you're 6%, or should we give you a gold star? No. Is just as unhealthy to be under as it is to be over. Because we rely on fat for all different functions in the body, for hormone balancing, for even just production of cells in general. So we need body fat, but we need good body fat, and we need to be in the right range is the key. You know, if you think about some of these, bodybuilders and this type of thing, you've seen pictures and posters, you know, where they're well defined, and you know, some have the posters up on their ceiling so they can see them in their bedroom when they go to sleep at night and dream that they look at like them one day. But it's not the ideal thing to become. Those people have such low body fat numbers. Do you have any idea what those numbers are? It can be 5%, 6% the very most. Now, what about someone who's anorexic? What percent body fat are they? Sometimes zero, right? But in many cases, you're anorexic at 5 and 6% easily. And so here we have these people who are these bodybuilders, proud to be 5% body fat, and yet we're condemning an anorexic girl who's 5% body fat. Health-wise, they're exactly the same inside. Their immune system is compromised. So it's not safe and not a safe level to be at. You want your body fat to be in the proper range in order for your immune system especially to be functioning. Well, do you ever hear this? But I don't like exercise. This was me. My picture should have been there. And honestly, there are days I don't like exercise. Just because it means I have to stop what I'm doing and go do it. And when I actually do it, I enjoy it and I need it. But you know, you can just become so busy in your work and your computer, and exercise goes beyond that. You know, when my kids walk in now and say, "Come on, Mom, we want to go bike riding." Sometimes I'll say, "I don't have time. Go with Dad, or go by yourselves, or you're okay. You know, I'll join you later." I have to stop and I realize, okay, you know what? This is what I need. They need me, I need them, but I need the exercise too. And so it goes beyond that, you know, and sometimes you just have to stop. And what is 30 minutes out of your life? Suddenly you come back and the work you were working on, you can think clearer and you can achieve more and you can get it done even faster. So taking the break, but the key is doing what you enjoy. If you don't like it, you know, think about something that you can do that you do like, that you do enjoy. And so don't let those common excuses or misconceptions sabotage your exercise program. So here we are. Maybe you've had a bad experience in the past. You know the philosophy, no pain, no gain. You might think of exercise as work or literally a workout. You don't like competition, never played sports, so you're just not active. These aren't the cases. The truth is, the no pain, no gain philosophy, the truth is you don't want pain. When you have pain, you're doing damage. And so that's why it's important to start at the level you're at and work your way up slowly. Now, pain can usually mean pulled ligaments and that sort of thing. So you're putting too much stress or strain on a particular part of your body. Now, you might occasionally get at the back of your legs, you might get just a tinge of a stinging pain, like a real quick little thing, like a prick, a pin prick sort of thing. If you get that periodically for just very, very short little bouts, that's not an issue. You know what that is? Without exercise, little blood vessels actually close off and the blood stops flowing through them. And once you begin to exercise, those vessels will pop open again and begin the blood flow. So when they pop open, you can have a little bit of a sting happen. So you just kind of rub it and move on. But if you're having it for longer than those few seconds, then that's an issue and you need to be careful of that. And also determine what's causing the pain. Sometimes it's just inappropriate shoes, you know. Sometimes, especially if you're doing walking every day as an exercise, it's worth investing in a good pair of runners. So again, make it a social occasion. Don't make it a workout. Make it something you enjoy. Have a pleasant surrounding. You know, take a different trail, a different, you know, yeah, pathway when you're walking outside. See something new and do things you enjoy. Gardening, hiking in the mountains, biking along a river. Make it different. What is the number one activity for depression? Does anyone know? Okay, what's the number one exercise? Okay, walking, I've told you so far, is the number one exercise. But what is even better?
Gardening.
Gardening is the number one exercise for depression. Do you know why? You're physically active, but you're also activating that frontal lobe of your brain, the very front portion where depression resides. You are now working that along with the physical exercise and working that soil. And that is healing to people. So that is the number one exercise for depression. So keep the intensity moderate. Don't overdo it, especially when you first start. Keep it varied. Experiment with new things, new places, classes, and so forth. All right, we still have time. We're going to talk about the benefits of water. And I'm going to end on just a little bit more to do with the exercise. But let me pop in here about water. Did you know the very last symptom of dehydration is a dry mouth or feeling like you're thirsty? Usually we wait for that symptom, don't we? And then we choose to drink water. But that's the very last thing that happens. So by the time that you feel thirsty, you're already dehydrated. I love it. When I talk water, everyone drinks water. And you're killing me because I have none. All right, by the time the dry mouth becomes an indicator of water shortage, many delicate functions of the body have been shut down and prepared for deletion. Now listen to this. This medically has not been proclaimed yet, and I don't know if it will totally be, but research is showing this now. Juvenile diabetes, which is type 1 diabetes, right? The insulin-producing cells of the pancreas are sacrificed as a result of persistent dehydration. So we are finding now that type 1 diabetes for children can be an issue of dehydration. Babies, are babies humans? Do babies need water? Yes, many cases we say babies don't need water, but babies do need water. Even if we are nursing the babies, when we nurse the babies, our milk begins more at a water stage and works to a creamier stage. However, that's still not enough pure water. So they still need a drop, just a drop of water here and there throughout the day. But babies specifically that are formula fed need water. And so formula fed babies, we need to implement more water into their diet. Oh, thank you. I should have known. This lady cares for me all the time. Oh, thank you, Judy Lynn. Okay. In the elderly, the thirst mechanism is gradually lost. Why? Because we haven't drank water for so long and we ignore the point of needing water that eventually the brain just stops telling you that you need water. And, you know, when I was seeing clients for the first while, one of my pages, my history page that I get my clients to fill out, it'll ask them different questions. One of the questions is, how many glasses of water do you drink per day? And the first time someone handed me a paper that said zero, I kind of chuckled because it was someone I knew and they were young and I thought they were kidding with me. And I said, oh, you know, come on, how many really do you drink? And they said, none. And I said, well, okay, how many... I mean, imagine, you sip here, you sip there, how much does it add up to? None. I don't sip water. I was just blown away by this. You never drink water? Never drink water. Okay, do you drink herb tea? No. Nope. I drink juice, I drink pop, but I don't drink water. And I think, wow, how do they function? Well, here we go. Another client comes in, how much water do you drink? None. Now, for a client to tell me they don't drink water or they might drink one glass a day is no longer a shock to me. It's very common to be found. And that is really scary. We need water. And I'll show you why, especially coming up here. Keeping well hydrated helps both body and mind work at peak efficiency. Your brain is the first thing to be affected by not enough water. Headaches are very common triggers, but just clarity. If you start to feel that you're not focused, you're not clear, that's a shortage of water. Especially more is needed if it's a hot day or you do heavy workouts. Water cools the body naturally. Now, I'm not talking drink cold water. In fact, drinking cold water can be a shock to your system. And if you have any digestion happening, it's got to stop. Warm that up. And then continue digestion. So cold water actually interferes with digestion. So you want preferably room temperature to just coolish water, not cold water. But water, just that liquid, cools the body. And when you sweat, when you exercise, that's the way of the body not only cleansing, you know, through toxins and the pores, but by cooling the body. It prevents fatigue. It's essential for good circulation. So you want to drink water in place of sugary drinks to save calories. Now, another thing I just quickly want to pop in here, a lot of times on hot days when we sweat and so forth, we lose a lot of potassium. And potassium is something that you really need to kind of balance out your electrolytes and so forth. If you find that someone starts to go through a form of a heat exhaustion and in towards a heat stroke, give them some potassium. And the best way to do that is mint tea. Mint tea is your highest source of potassium. And because it's in a liquid form of tea, it absorbs like an IV. It goes through no digestion, so it's instant absorption. I've had people that have almost passed out from the heat, laying on the floor. They have the ice packs, the fans, the whole ordeal. And I'll get down there and give them just some room temperature, you know, mint tea to drink and sip. And in 20 minutes, they're walking around. So it's an ideal thing. In the heat, you can get a lot of swelling in your legs, in your feet. Potassium is the trick. In the heat, you may find your blood pressure goes up. That's the lack of potassium. So mint tea will help bring down your blood pressure. If you're finding the heat is pushing it up, then mint tea can be helpful to that as well. So I tell people, if you've worked outside and it's been a hot day, end your day with a cup of mint tea. It just restores your potassium overall. It's, well, you know, it's a good thing to do before bed. Yes, any kind of mint. Mint tea, yeah. Yes. You know what? You can have it either or. You can do it like a hot herbal tea, or you can let it cool down and drink it at that point. So either or is fine. Yeah. Any other? Yes?
Seems to me that 6 to 8 glasses, you'd have to vary that because there's a lot of people out bigger and more active. That, you know.
Yes.
That there should be some...
Yes, it definitely. It makes a difference. Like I'm saying, you need more on those when you're working out in hot days, and it does vary according to your body shape as well. This is true. In a man versus a woman, that can make a difference, and a child versus an adult. But 6 to 8 is the average. You know, yeah. The meeting ends at what? 12, right? 12, yeah. Yeah. Okay. We'll excuse you. Yes? Bladder problems, you just said? Yes. So the question was, some people have a hard time drinking the 6 to 8 glasses of water a day because of bladder issues. You have to determine as well. You know, you don't need to necessarily drink that whole glass of water in one sitting. You want to add it up to the 6 to 8 glasses. So even just having sips throughout the day is really important. But a lot of times we kind of go on this reserve thing of not drinking water because we're afraid of having to keep running to the washroom, especially at nighttime. And so we'll dehydrate ourselves through the night so we don't have to get up. But remember, what did we talk about yesterday? Dehydration through the night increases our risk of a heart attack, right? So even if we can have a little sip of water here and there, we'll make that difference. The other thing is sometimes then when we kind of restrict the water and we drink it, the body now doesn't know what to do with it because we've never given it enough water. And so it'll just kind of keep going right through you. But if you kind of put up with it for a little bit, the body then realizes, oh, this is something I'm going to get all the time, and it starts to actually use it. So people who get a lot of edema and fluid and stuff, a lot of times that has to do with not enough water in their diet. And if they can increase the water, suddenly that edema will actually reverse itself as well. But I hope that helps. You know, one of the things that can be helpful for especially men with prostate and issues getting up at night to the washroom is selenium. And eating a few Brazil nuts every day has helped them. So it doesn't help everybody, but it does help a number of men that have talked to me about that, eating at least 3 Brazil nuts a day. And in general, I tell people to eat 2-3 Brazil nuts every day at breakfast, and you've got enough selenium for your entire day. And selenium, we know, is a good base, again, for cancer prevention. So 2 or 3 Brazil nuts every morning for breakfast is ideal. Right. And that's coming. I will address that. Yes. No? Good. See, I have good students. Keep me going. On my toes. Okay. A mistake to think they can substitute for water are some of these other liquids, as we mentioned. So these beverages, I talked about them yesterday as far as the caffeine goes. And what happens is, again, for those who weren't here, the caffeine that... What happens is the substances rid the body of the water they are dissolved in, plus additional water from the body's reserves. So one cup of coffee can actually pull out of your body another 2 to 10 cups of water, depending on the type of coffee you're drinking. So coffee, you think, is a liquid, and it's hydrating you, and in reality, it's dehydrating you even more so. Now, I thought I had, this is a different program. Oh, here we go, finally. Different program than what I intended to show you on the water. And what I want to show you here is how much your body is actually comprised of water. Overall, if I was to average the whole thing out, you are 75% water. Isn't that huge? So tell me now, if you're 75% water, don't you think you need water? We're going to shrivel up like prunes otherwise. So here we are. Muscles are 70% water. So muscles being 70% water, when you exercise, your muscles are depending on water. So it's really important to have a sip of water every so many minutes while you're exercising, and that'll keep you going. If you find you get tired and run out of energy, it's usually because you've ran out of water and your muscles have no water to rely on. Secondly, remember I said the brain was the first thing to be sensitive to dehydration? It's because it's 90% water. There's sort of a little bit of controversy on that, 80 to 90%, but still 80% is pretty high too, isn't it? And so again, the most significant major complication of dehydration is the loss of a number of essential amino acids that are used to manufacture neurotransmitters. And neurotransmitters are basically these messengers sending out the messages from your brain to all the parts of your body, telling it what to do and how to work and run. And if they start to get crisscrossed and confused, there's an issue, isn't there? So water will keep the brain working at those peak levels. Circulation. You know, even a disease or an issue like varicose veins. Most people think, well, varicose veins, that's not a disease. That just happens to be something that happens. But it's not. Varicose veins is due to circulation. So if you're getting varicose veins, you have to see what you can do to increase your circulation. And water, again, is important. It transports all the nutrients throughout your body, so circulation needs to happen. And it'll clean your blood in your body. Another thing people don't think about is that water keeps your skin soft and youthful. So if you don't want to age as quickly and you want to keep looking young and alive, then drink lots of water. All right, many cases, the mistake of dehydration for a disease, treating the symptoms with medication rather than water. Full hydration many times can even prevent conditions such as heartburn, allergies, and even asthma. So the reason is the rate of the histamine production in the body will increase rapidly when the body becomes more and more dehydrated. So if you suffer asthma and you begin to feel wheezy and this type of thing, drink some water, and this will help prevent an asthma attack coming on, or allergies in general. You know, I know when some people first came to this camp at the beginning of the week, their eyes were running and swollen and their nose were running and they're coughing, and they said, what do I do, what do I do? Drink lots of water. Just drink and drink and drink and drink. And you can just kind of flush that out, and now I see them and they look completely fine. So it just kind of, you know, you need to, it sets it up that it controls your histamine production now, and your body can deal with it on a different level. When there is dehydration because a person's not drinking enough water, your cells become depleted of their ready energy. They then have to depend on energy generation from food that is consumed instead of water. You actually need water to set up the digestion for your food to come. If you don't have that water, then your body is pushed into storing the fat and using protein and starch reserves, because it is easier to break these elements down than the stored fat. So if you want to lose weight, you drink lots of water and your body will burn the fat faster. Yes? That's right. If you don't have a thirst for drinking water, then you drink it anyways. Doesn't matter anymore. And eventually your body will get used to it and start to use the water, and pretty soon you will have that need again and that desire again. You can bring it back. So one of the main contributing factors in the development of obesity in the young and the old is the confusion of hunger for thirst. They mistakenly eat food to satisfy their thirst sensation. So, and you know, one of the first symptoms of dehydration is a headache. And that's where I was just mentioning about the medication. When we get a headache, we don't think of drinking a glass of water. We think of taking an aspirin, don't we? Absolutely. I'm going to talk more about lemons, hopefully tomorrow. but yeah, lemon is excellent because it makes your body alkaline, it aids in dehydration, and it sets the stomach up to make hydrochloric acid. So that's fine. The only risk comes in with the ascorbic acid, so you just need to brush your teeth regularly. Doesn't mean you have to brush with toothpaste, but use a toothbrush to brush it. Yeah. So, you want to drink a couple of glasses, one or two glasses when you first wake up in the morning. You want to drink between your meals, not during. You want to keep a bottle of water at your desk or workstation. You know, when you have a cup or a water bottle, just subconsciously you're sipping it all the time. And before long, it's gone. That's the best way to do it. Drink before you exercise, as well as during and after. But whatever you do, don't stop at the end of your exercise and drink a glass of cold water. It's such a shock to the heart, you can have an instant heart attack. Yes? No, no, no. You can put as much lemon in as you would like. Yeah.
If I take one every morning.
That would be fine. I suggest 1 to 2 tablespoons is what is needed. But if you add more, that is fine. Yeah. All right. So I was going to end with some stretches. So we don't have a lot of time to try these out. But just to kind of give you a quick little rundown on this. A lot of times we do stretches before we go on those brisk walks. But you want to be really gentle with that. Stretch slowly and a little bit, but not a lot. The best thing to do is actually when you begin your walk, walk slow for a while and then slowly speed your way up. And when you're done your walk, do the same thing. Gradually slow down and walk slow for a little bit at the end. And then do your stretches. You will have less risk of ligament tears and pulls. All right? This just gives you some little examples. The reason for stretching, everyone should do some form of stretching. It promotes posture, injury prevention, decreased tension, you know, especially if you carry a lot of tension in your shoulders, in your neck. I tend to be like that and I'll get tighter and tighter like this. And so I need to stretch to loosen that area up. It improves your circulation then as well. And so choose a variety of stretches. And you can stretch all parts of your body every day. If you're doing actual weight-bearing exercises or, you know, where you're doing, you know, your arm curls and your leg curls, don't do those same exercises every day. You need a day between to heal those muscles. So what I suggest is work on your upper body one day, your lower body the next day, and just alternate that if you're doing actual weight training type exercises. But stretching can be done every day. And the best time, first thing in the morning, to stretch and get yourself all lined up. But when you wake up in the morning, if you do nothing else, do that first stretch, first thing in the morning. Lay in your bed, reach as high as you can, put your hands together and point your toes and just stretch before you get out of bed. And you will feel much different stepping out of your bed than if you didn't do that. The other couple of things I'll just quickly mention. When you're holding a stretch, hold for 10 to 30 seconds. Never really past that 30 seconds. The other thing is, you know, as you're stretching, stretch, and you can kind of push a little further and push yourself, but never bounce. When you bounce, you tug and you can rip your ligaments and cause injury. So we used to do this bouncing thing. Don't bounce, okay? So just stretch and hold. And you only want to do it 2 to 4 times in a total of 1 minute is all. That's all you need to do for each side. All right, let me see here. I think we're almost done. Here's some neck stretches. One thing we used to do is curl our head around. Don't do that. You will grind all the tiny little bones, and that's bad for you. So just kind of, you know, stretch, hold, stretch, hold. And you can use your hand to pull a little bit harder. Of course, there's exercises you can do even at your desk. Sitting exercises, we don't have time for all these. Even back exercises, which can really help you if you are somebody, you know, who goes to a chiropractor a lot. Stretching can make a difference. I'm going to share this with you tomorrow because I didn't want to miss this. These are three amazing stories I want to share with you that are so motivating that have to do with the fact that people think they're too old to exercise. And when you hear these three stories, you will realize you're never too old to exercise. So I'm going to kick off tomorrow's class with those three stories. So let's just bow our heads and have a closing prayer.